Welcome. I'm really excited to be here with this group of people who are really on the cutting edge of innovation in life sciences and the automation of life sciences and drug development. We could just take a minute, maybe each of you could tell us a little bit about your piece of the puzzle here and what you're doing. So Jake, can you tell us a little bit about Strand?
So Strand Therapeutics is a next generation messenger RNA therapeutics company. So we're deploying things like synthetic biology and programmable nucleic acids in order to fix some of the shortcomings of messenger RNA technology to enable the expansion beyond vaccines and into an actual therapeutic modality. So we can treat diseases like cancer, autoimmune diseases, and rare diseases.
And you have several drugs that are in development right now.
Right, yeah. So we have a pretty broad platform across cancer and immunology right now. And actually, our first drug is slated to enter the clinic around the midpoint of next year. So we'll be going into our first phase one in triple negative breast cancer and a few other solid tumor types next year.
Wow, exciting. So that's a big advance in synthetic biology. That's great.
Yeah, we'll be some of the first programmable nucleic acid medicines in history to ever hit the clinic.
Wow. Nikita, what's your involvement in life sciences? You're doing something a little bit different.
Yeah, so I thought I'd be a scientist and then got wooed by the world of robots. And so I'm co-founder of a company called Artificial. And really what we're trying to do is make automation more accessible to scientists. So all the folks in like Jake's lab, for example, are the types of people that we love to work with. And so for us, really, like, I don't know how many of you have stepped foot in a lab, but today, if a scientist wants to run an experiment, the tools they often have at their disposal are things like paper, a bunch of USBs, a lot of Windows XP running equipment. And so the idea for us is to have an entire software platform so that more and more people can automate and leverage robots as part of their experimentation.
Cool. And Victoria, you know these people.
A little bit too well, but yeah.
So you're investing in this space. What sort of companies and technologies are you looking at?
Yeah, of course. And just to backtrack a little bit, so I'm a VC investor at a deep tech venture capital firm called Playground Global. At Playground, we love to back companies that have deep technical risk but shallow market risks, which, you know, Artificial and Strand are kind of in the course of that. And I think particularly how that's relevant in the life sciences space, I think it's actually we're at a very interesting time to be investing at the intersection of life sciences and technology, particularly because these are two sectors have really been kind of siloed and decoupled in the last couple of decades, right? Like not only philosophically, but even physically, right? Like if you're a U.S. investor, like it's very well known that East Coast Boston biotech VCs versus, you know, West Coast tech VCs. And I sit at an intersection of this Venn diagram where I get to see innovation happening in the life sciences, but also, you know, in all these different sectors of tech, like IT, enterprise software, next-gen manufacturing, and the use of robotics and automation in, you know, maybe more backwater sectors like logistics, supply chain, agriculture, and really what are the learnings that we can get from those industries and apply that onto life sciences so that we can actually bring life-changing medicines and drive better patient outcome.
Yeah. So there's different phases of drug development that we talk about, sort of the discovery phase, there's a clinical translation phase, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about how AI and automation are affecting each of those phases. So Jake, could you just talk a little bit about how sort of AI models are helping to predict and design, you know, the protein structures that form the basis of new therapeutics. And how sort of this idea of DNA and RNA as code is a real shift from the kind of traditional, like, molecular drug development process.
So I think the best known case of AI impacting like life sciences recently is going to be like DeepMind and AlphaFold, right? So AlphaFold being able to use machine learning to actually predict protein structures. And that's what folks have been trying to focus on for a long time, which is how do we take AI tools and actually innovate where biotech is today, but the future, so nucleic acids especially, are just at their core code. They're not ones and zeros, they're A, T, G, and C, or in the case of mRNA, A, U, G, and C. Yeah. And so since that's just still a sort of code with four bases instead of two, you can actually train a lot of AI models in the same sort of way, and you can look at this sort of these sequence codes. If you have huge data sets, of course, which is then enabled by automation, right? If you can build these giant millions and millions of points of data sets of various different nucleic acid codes, you can train a number of different models to actually build this next type of therapeutic. Now, that was never achievable before, right? So this is really about utilizing the tools we have today to sort of, in a native model, build new tools for drug discovery on new modalities, right? So it's multiple different avenues of innovation where you're able to say, okay, if we have a completely new paradigm, if we have DNA or messenger RNA-based drugs, and these are all based on this sort of code, can we then also use these different models we have to look at that code, right? With small molecules or with proteins, we weren't able to look at such multifactorial data in the same way because proteins aren't so, you know, they don't have little sequences that you can modulate in tiny ways like you can with DNA. Right. And so what we're doing at Strand is the exact same thing. We're utilizing automation tools, we're utilizing high throughput data and high density data, training it across machine learning models in order to pull out sequences that have never existed in nature, but are so much more advanced and so much more optimized for actually use in a therapeutic context.
Wow. So really a key enabling technology in what you're talking about is the ability to do sequencing quickly and relatively cheaply and to synthesize DNA and RNA. And Victoria, I know you have some exciting investments in that space, and there have been some real significant breakthroughs there. Can you just tell us a little bit about what's happening in sort of that sequencing space?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the use of AI and what Jake has been talking about, really, in enabling kind of the design of novel proteins, novel therapeutic modalities is super awesome. It's super important. But even like taking that a step back, right, where do you get the data, right? So fundamentally, we kind of need one of the investments we've made in this company called Ultima Genomics, which we led the Series A for, and recently they came out of stealth after raising $600 million without a website, which is not unheard of, but you know, it happens. And really, they are so special because they figured out a way to innovate on the gene sequencing space, which has traditionally been very, very expensive and inefficient, and they figured out a way to create a novel architecture that can bring down sequencing costs by 10x. So right now, today, you can use the Ultima machine and sequence a whole genome for $100. Which is insane. And so then you imagine the level of data that now is unleashed into the real world, and what can you do with that, right?
Wow. So $100 is really amazing. Like, tell us, how much did it cost to sequence the first whole human genome?
Yeah. So, I mean, also just the premise of that company, right? So we've sequenced the Human Genome Project was something that was done, you know, about 20 years ago with billions of dollars that went into it, and we sequenced kind of 3 billion bases, and we think like, oh, we're done, right? No, not really, right? That was just for one person, and there are 7 billion of us on this earth, right? How can you possibly really understand different diseases at the level that you need, and also how can you possibly understand what are different patients from different populations' responses to different drugs without that data?
Yeah.
So that's where we've come a very, very far away, and you know, the need for more breadth of data, but also more depth of data, right? So not only sequence at a much wider population level scale, but also be able to sequence and detect rare events and all of that. And if you can do that and also do it in a more frequent way, right? So if I can just do a genome-based test every year, now, this is just a big data challenge.
Yeah. Nikita, if you go into a cutting-edge life sciences lab today. In some of them, there are far more robots than people. They're you know, measuring chemical reagents, putting things into, you know, well plates. There's a lot of automation there, but there's more to this than just buying a bunch of liquid handling robots, dropping in your lab and letting them work. So how do you sort of help to put these systems together, make things talk to each other? Like, what's your role there?
Yeah, I mean, so to your point around, like, there's some labs that I would say have a bunch of robots and machines, but I think the vast majority of labs we walk into, there's, like, a ton of instruments that are sitting, and it becomes sort of part of the expensive paperweight problem where they've spent millions of dollars and they don't actually get utilized in the ways that they could. And a big part of that is because science is not like manufacturing a car, right? Like, it's far more complex. It has certain flexibility you need to it. Yeah. And automation and flexibility are not often synonymous with each other. And so you have this kind of friction where how do you make automation tools that are flexible and can change and adapt to the science? And so I think what we notice and really how we come in is, like, you have all this equipment, you've spent the money, let's think about actually the workflows you want to run in a standardized way, and then start to reflect all of those workflows in a digital format. So can you describe all the work you want to do, what people need to do, what the machines need to do, and then what data you need? And as you start to describe all of that and encode it in a digital way, that means I can now schedule it, I can measure it, I can manage it, and I know exactly what's happening in my lab. And so it's kind of like taking all the paper and all the Windows XP and all the USBs and starting to build it into real software that's accessible, right? And I think that's really like our, you know, foot in the door is like, let's digitize your workflows, take that, and then let you have visibility in a command center for your whole lab.
Right. So where does life sciences fit in on the spectrum of sort of other industries in embracing this kind of approach? So we see like process optimization in other industries. Has life sciences been slower to adopt some of this?
I definitely, and I think it goes to like Victoria's point around there's sort of two silos and people don't talk to each other. And I think when, you know, we first started with artificial, like I had very little experience in the science space other than running immunology assays for like several years as kind of a lab minion, I would say. And, you know, I kind of went in and the first piece that we heard from people was like, if you've seen one lab, you've seen one lab, right? You're never going to be able to build like a core platform. And I think that's because life science is complicated. Robots and automation are complicated. And you put two experts in a room and try to get them to talk to each other, like everything is complicated, right? And I think in reality, though, like what people are trying to do in a lab is a lot like other industries. Like they want a process. They want more standardization. They want to be able to have the human in the loop knowing when they need to give something attention. Like the principles are the same.
Yeah.
And so it just takes kind of that perspective of like, let's start at first principles and build up from there and borrow from what we already know from like manufacturing and other industries that have kind of been doing this for decades, right?
Yeah. So Jake, let me ask you this, since you're one of these companies. How does having more automation affect the headcount at these companies? I mean, is this putting people out of work, or is it sort of shifting the roles of humans?
So I think that life sciences is interesting because whereas, you know, when you automate like a manual task, most of the time you are taking maybe something that's more of an unskilled labor class or a harder labor class, and then automating it so that you can, you know, free up workspace, and there are risks about decreasing the workforce. But when we think about automation at Strand, actually, and the way that you think about actually hiring scientists is, you know, most of the time that my scientists are actually working at the bench and doing repetitive tasks, they're actually sort of wasting their time, right? Because intellectually, they can contribute so much more to the company if they're sitting and designing experiments and conversing with their fellow scientists. And so as we invest deeper and deeper into automation, as we build more of these repetitive tasks together, we actually think about that as freeing up intellectual bandwidth on the same headcount. So now with the same amount of capital, the same amount of FTEs that we allocate for, we can do 10x more science. And then to go even one step further with some of the automation that we've been able to do, now we're able to actually generate data that's just frankly impossible to do correctly at scale, right? If you want to screen through thousands of different types of reaction conditions, for instance, to like produce a given messenger RNA, that's frankly just impossible to do by hand because you have experimental variability. You can't have one person do it. You have multiple people doing it. There's tiny changes that will happen throughout the entire ecosystem. And so you fundamentally can't even generate that data. So the data that we're now able to generate with automation has been able to give us answers that we just didn't have before. Like, we had no way to get before. And so I'm incredibly excited about what we've built so far and sort of the data that is now rolling almost in an automated capacity off of our machines. We're not quite to the level where the scientists can just, you know, sit at home at night, write up some code and push it to some cloud lab. However, we're getting closer and closer to that point. And like Nikita just said, we're hoping that, you know, AI and machines are more a partner at the table to this innovation. And that's really what we're building towards. But to go one step further about the entire biotech industry, since I know there is a mixed audience here, this is by no means the sort of base case scenario within biotech. Life sciences and tech have been crashing together for like the last 10 years. And we're finally seeing now with a lot more companies that are tech enabled, really building in a native system, ground up solutions to some of these problems that have plagued biotech forever.
Yeah.
So I think just an incredibly exciting time overall.
Yeah, it's very cool. So how are these changes affecting the makeup of companies in terms of the demand for talent and the types of skills that people are coming in with? So I'll just throw this out to all of you. Well, maybe Nikita, you could talk because you mentioned you don't come from a biology background. So, like, who are the people who work at your company?
Yeah, so we kind of have an intersection of like three groups, I would say. We have folks who are life science experts, and then robots and automation experts, and then UI and UX folks, actually. Because I think for us, like, making tools accessible has been kind of a core priority. I think in the life science space, at least from like the companies we've worked with, what we notice is more software engineers coming over from like the kind of tech side and starting to work in the bio space. And I think that'll help with some of this proliferation. And I also think, you know, I actually think you still need a ton of scientists, to Jake's point, because if you think about other industries, like, there's more bounding to the problem. Like, I need to manufacture X number of cars. But the scientific space is still unbounded. Like, we don't actually know what we don't know. And so you still need that talent to be able to basically create the creative hypotheses that you want to run through the system. And automation really becomes a way to, like, iterate on your hypotheses exponentially faster.
Yeah.
And so I still see, like, the same makeup of, like, a lot of scientists, a lot of research associates to support them, but more and more of the software talent kind of bridging over a little bit as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Victoria, I just wanted to, Ultima is sort of an interesting case study, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you take away one thing from this talk is that this industry is all about Venn diagrams and the intersection of a lot of different, chemistry, biology, machine learning, traditional software infrastructure, and we've been definitely seeing kind of just more folks that are traditionally, you know, classically trained computer scientists and ML folks, and now wanting to apply their talents into the healthcare space. And, you know, Ultima is such a great example of that also, because the CEO didn't come from the sequencing space himself. He actually came from the semiconductor industry, which, hey, it turns out if you take an industry and the learnings from an industry where we've thrown trillions of dollars and decades of innovation at, and it's all about, you know, high throughput and higher and higher, faster data rates every 2 years, those are incredible learnings that helps really innovate the next, you know, generation of life sciences companies as well.
So I see the clock ticking, and I want to make sure that we finish by looking forward here. And, we talk about all these things speeding up the drug development process, but fast in biology is different than fast in tech. So, where are we and how far do we have to go to seeing, AI drugs happening?
I'm we're at the beginning of the beginning, right? I mean, the first AI, like AI right now in drug development is just so crude, right? We're looking at models that were built for something else that are being applied to biology. But now we're seeing companies actually building models from the ground up and using new technology to actually train and build drugs in an AI or in a native environment to life sciences. And so we're in day one in my mind.
Yeah, Nikita, we still need a few things to fill in here, right, to sort of make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think AI has a ton of promise, and there's a lot of opportunity for it to see things that humans can't, but I think we're still far away for three kind of big reasons, right? Like, one is the data isn't structured and consolidated, so if you don't have good data, your AI model is not going to be great either. And then I think the other piece is humans actually have a lot of intuition, and, like, I've gone into labs where people are like, this only works when Joe flicks the vial in this specific way, right? And so in order to capture a lot of the human intuition, you need tools to be able to put that into software, into AI models. And I think the third thing is actual explainability of AI models. Like, if you're going to get your therapies through all of the regulation, and for us to just understand our biology and not just be throwing data at a TensorFlow model and see what happens, it's sort of, we need explainability of the systems that we build.
Right. So we're getting there. It's coming. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you all so much.
Great.